Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. When we think about innovation, we tend to think about things, high-tech things.
Like scientists in lab coats or lines of computer code.
Or the latest electronic gadget or app or mobile device.
Or some innovation district startup working on a pharmaceutical breakthrough or a new social media platform.
The next Facebook, the next Twitter.
That kind of innovation is often pointed to as a way to boost local economies. It's why many communities are creating startup incubators.
And why they celebrate when companies like Google or Microsoft come to town.
But what if that's the wrong way to think about economic revival, especially in cities and towns really struggling financially, like Lowell and Holyoke and New Bedford? Why not instead, and this may sound totally counterintuitive, why not turn to farming or fishing or factory work, trades that made many cities so strong a century or so ago? In other words, why don't we innovate? In a recent article in the Boston Globe, reporter Ben Schreckinger called for a return to what he describes as economic strategies that are rooted in our past and can complement the gee whiz innovation celebrated in Boston. We have Ben here in the studio to talk about his proposal. Ben Schreckinger, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Catherine Tumber. She's a visiting scholar at Northeastern University and author of the book Small, Gritty, and Green, The Promise of America's Smaller Industrial Cities in a Low-Carbon World. Catherine, thanks to you, too.
Thank you, Sasha.
And with us by phone from Maine is Molly Anderson. She's a faculty member at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, and she helped produce a report that is calling for boosting the region's agricultural production. Molly, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me on your show.
And listeners, we want to hear from you also. We want to know if you think that when we consider what innovation means, we're thinking too narrowly when we just think about devices and gadgets. Do you think that industries that might seem old-fashioned, like farming or fishing or manufacturing, could actually help revive dying communities? What does it mean to be innovative when you're not in a Boston or a Cambridge or a Silicon Valley? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Ben Schreckinger, this term innovation is not, you didn't coin it. It's been around for a few years. I think one of the earliest references you found was Harvard Business Review. But tell us what it means to innovate. What is an innovation?
Sure. An innovation is anything that produces value that is more about turning towards things that have worked in the past and is less about seeking out novelty when it's not valuable.
So give us some examples.
Sure. So, for example, in Maine, there's a new charter school called the Harpswell Coastal Academy that's educational model is based on project-based learning that's entrepreneurial and based on sustainable resource cultivation. So it's looking around at the forests in Maine, the fields in Maine, the coast in Maine, and looking at opportunities for making a livelihood that resemble what these kids' grandparents were doing.
So people might think that an innovation is something that begins with the letter I, right? The next I device, the next razor with 12 blades instead of 11 blades, right? But the idea here is that you can be innovative in a way that doesn't have to be in a lab. There can be older school ways of doing things that might work better in communities that aren't Boston's and Cambridge's.
Sure. And you can integrate innovations into things like manufacturing. There's plenty of high-tech manufacturing going on in New England. There's plenty of innovation in terms of aquaculture going on in New England. But it doesn't have to even be innovative. It can be not particularly innovative, but still be a good thing because it's the source of a decent, well-paying job.
When you try to define innovation in your own mind, what do you think of it as meaning?
Sure. So an innovation is really just anything that's new, although it currently has a much more positive connotation with the idea that it's both new and valuable. But I think, you know, you can always take a harder look at whether something's actually creating value.
The first reference you came across to innovation in that Harvard Business Review was kind of a disparaging way to look at the word. It was like innovations done for just the sake of seeming to innovate, and instead they were kind of failures. Like they pointed out the Hummer, which kind of was a big drag on the manufacturer because it was such a gas guzzler and so forth. So you're putting a more positive spin on what innovation could mean.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be new to be good.
Now, of course, innovation in the high-tech sense has worked quite nicely for Boston and Cambridge. But I you're arguing that sort of this recipe does not work everywhere. Give us a sense of what communities you think aren't benefiting or just haven't had the opportunity to be kind of high-tech innovators and how they could benefit from thinking in an innovative way.
Sure. So the gateway cities in Massachusetts are a great example of this. They're never going to be high-tech superclusters or life sciences superclusters.
Why not? Why do you think they never would be?
Basically because Boston's already the big fish in that pond, and it already enjoys the benefits of the network effect. You know, if you're going to be within 100 miles of Boston and you're going to be in tech or you're going to be in life sciences, it makes sense to be, you know, very close to Boston. It doesn't make sense to try to go off on your own and start a new cluster.
So where does it leave those gateway cities in terms of what they can do to revive themselves?
Well, a lot of them still have manufacturing sectors that provide a lot of jobs, but those manufacturing sectors have an aging workforce. It's estimated that over the course of the next decade, they're going to need to fill 100,000 jobs. And so one of the ways they're finding the most success, because they are having a lot of trouble convincing young people to go into the industry, is to work with local vocational schools and local community colleges to create a better integrated pipeline between the schools and the companies and make sure that students basically know that this is an option.
Catherine Tumber, I want to turn to you on this because you've written a book that deals with manufacturing, and you talk about how basically manufacturing is kind of disparaged. It has a reputational problem. So as Ben was saying, there are industries out there, manufacturing industries, that have a pretty big need for employees, and they're having a recruiting problem because people don't have the skills, and it's hard to get young people thinking that's a viable career path. So tell us what you think the reputation of manufacturing is.
Well, it doesn't have a very good reputation in this country. Since the dawn of the neoliberal era, there has been an assumption that manufacturing is being displaced in the United States, and in fact it's been true, by the rise of the high-tech knowledge sector. And there's a you know, sort of global division of labor where we do all the brain work, and all the production work has been moved overseas, and that has in fact largely happened, not completely. And as a result, we've had a whole generation and a half of, young adults coming into the workforce who don't think of manufacturing as a forward-looking career path. And we've lost a lot of the infrastructure that supports that, the community colleges and vocational schools that provide the skills to prepare people for that work. It's also true that manufacturing is showing signs of returning to the United States for all kinds of reasons. One of the reasons is that much of the innovation, we talk a lot about innovation in terms of high, big science breakthrough innovation, mm-hmm. of the sort that happens in Silicon Valley and right. here in Boston and Cambridge, but also there's a different kind of innovation, which is the kind of innovation that takes place on the shop floor. It's called process and product innovation. And because our factories, because the shop floors have been overseas, we have lost our edge in developing that sort of innovation.
And when you talk about manufacturing that's still around, are you talking both about sort of dirty, old-fashioned manufacturing and some of the kind of clean tech, spotless assembly line kind of work, a little of both?
What I started to say is that the manufacturing that is beginning to crop up here again is advanced manufacturing. So it is innovative too, and it's much more high tech and computerized than the kind of sort of like old industrial satanic mills type factory work that we associate with manufacturing.
But even some of those companies, and I think, Ben, you found an example of this at GE and Lin, where there are jobs that pay quite well, $80,000, $90,000 a year, and sometimes even those jobs aren't finding people available to take them or wanting to take them.
Sure, that's actually an example that Catherine gave me when I interviewed her for the piece. But I also got an email yesterday from a young entrepreneur in Hartford, which is one of the few cities in the country that's losing population. And he's working with a company called the Brothers Crisp that does high-end boutique shoemaking. And he sees a lot of promise in this idea, but he basically says that he can't go out and advertise for a shoemaker job because no one's going to respond to that.
So, Catherine Tumber, what's the solution to sort of revamping manufacturing's image? How do we make young people think that is a viable career opportunity and then have people available in the pipeline to fill those jobs?
That's a very good question. I'm really not quite sure. Part of it involves preparing I really don't know how to answer that question.
But it's kind of key to the argument, isn't it?
It is key to the argument. It's also true that, you know, people who have been preparing themselves to think in terms of doing white-collar work aren't the only source of workforce development. There are people who we call them blue-collar, the working poor who could be better prepared for these kinds of jobs if we restored the educational infrastructure to prepare them. And there has been a lot of effort and a lot more talk about developing the workforce for that kind of work.
Listener,
we have a long way to go, 30 years worth of deconstructing it.
Listeners, we're talking about the concept of innovation, that when we think innovation, we tend to think high-tech, electronics, gadgets, pharmaceutical innovations. And really, we should be thinking about older fashion types of innovation, fishing and farming and manufacturing as a way to help some communities that haven't really been places where incubators and startups come. We want to hear if you think that seems viable. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Ben and Catherine, I want to bring in Molly Anderson. Again, Molly, you're at the College of the Atlantic. You're at a conference today in Maine, so thank you for taking time out of your day to talk with us. And as we mentioned, you worked on a report called A New England Food Vision. It makes a somewhat radical proposal. You know, you're calling for the region to triple the amount of agricultural land under cultivation. And this doesn't just have to do with more locally grown food, but as a way to create more jobs and generate more economic activity for the region, kind of a return to farming, which sounds pretty old-fashioned. So how did this report come out to be?
The report actually originated as an idea of Russell Libby, who unfortunately passed away before the report was finished. He was the executive director of the Maine Organic Farming and Gardening Association. He and Brian Donahue, who is the first author on the report, were at a conference at the Spinocchio Foundation in Italy. And they were looking around at this beautiful Tuscany farmland, this gorgeous landscape, and saying, why can't New England be more like this? Why can't we have a beautiful farm landscape? So they put their heads together and tried to figure out how much of the food that we eat could we feasibly produce in New England if we really put all of our effort into it. And they came up with this report. We have about, I think, in addition to Brian, there are six co-authors who contributed in various ways to the report. I want to say in that it ties in with the earlier comments about innovation and incubators. The kind of farming that we're seeing emerging in New England and that has young people in particular really excited is not old-fashioned farming. There still is some farming that I think it would be fair to call old-fashioned.
What's old-fashioned versus new-fashioned farming?
Well, commodity agriculture and dairy to some extent is a very strong, viable form of farming in New England. Viable, I say, in the sense that it matches our landscape very well. It matches our natural resources very well. It's not a great living, though, for the people who are in dairy farming.
Right, and that's a key point. In fact, there was we were looking at the agricultural census recently. It said that half of farmers make $2,500 or less a year. Very little money. That's bad enough.
Yeah.
But then there was a New York Times article a few days ago that I know you've read. It was headlined, "Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers." It said that the median U.S. farm income in 2012 was almost negative $1,500. So how, Molly Anderson, do you kind of defend your proposal in light of this idea that it seems like it's not viable for us to look at farming as a way to sort of revive economies?
Well, I think there are two things that we have to keep in mind here. One is that the context of farming and food is changing radically. We can see that with the drought in California. We can see that with impending climate change. Things are going to change, and food is going to become a lot more expensive because the resources that we depend on for food are becoming both more volatile and more limited. New England is actually in a very good situation. We have a lot of water. We also have a lot of land that is not being used to full capacity. At the meeting that I'm attending today at the Maine Food Strategy, I was talking to a fellow who's an economic developer in Aroostook County, which is at the north end of Maine. And there is so much land up there that is not fully used that could be put into growing the food that we need. So as food becomes more expensive, I think that we're going to see farming livelihoods become far more viable for the young people who are eager to go into farming. The second thing about the report that was in the New York Times, Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers, mm-hmm. I think it did the disservice of performing an overgeneralization. It took data about farming as a whole and said because farming as a whole is not does not have good economic returns for most small-scale farmers, then therefore no small-scale farmers can make it. But in fact, there are people who are making very nice livings off of small-scale farming if they have found direct marketing, community-supported agriculture, some of the ways that people have found to reconnect with their consumers. And that's what the young people who are excited about going into farming want to be doing. They want to be doing that more innovative kind of farming that results in direct marketing and that's using agroecological practices or organic practices that are not as environmentally destructive
Interesting.
As full-scale farming.
Listeners, we want to know what you think about that. Can you imagine yourself, your kids, other young people you know, going into farming as a way at this stage sort of in life and society as a way to sort of have an economic lift? We want to hear about your thoughts on this idea of innovation, that it doesn't always have to be high-tech in a lab. It sometimes can be types of farming or fishing or manufacturing that might be a way to help some struggling communities, not the Bostons and the Cambridges that are largely doing well, but the Holyokes, the Lawrences, the Gateway Cities. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Steve calling from Cambridge. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to do a quick plug for manufacturing. Can't speak much to farming and fishing. Don't know much about that. But your listeners should know that manufacturing is vibrant in the U.S., vibrant in Massachusetts. We've got something like 3,000 manufacturing companies in the Commonwealth. And to the point about the innovation, the reason we have so many of these companies and the reason they're really cool places to work is that as technology has shifted both product and process, the work in these factories is not turning wrenches in dark, dirty, smokestack environments. It's problem solving from dawn to dusk. And it's incredibly challenging work, very rewarding work, making something that's valuable for someone else. And the last point is the reason we have so much of this in Massachusetts is that you can outsource to China, Mexico, elsewhere if you're chasing cheap labor, cheap commodities. But if you want to be doing work that's solving someone else's problem, you got to be near that person to have some sort of empathy to the problem that you're trying to deliver a solution
for. Steve, you're a good manufacturer for cheerleading. Catherine Tumber, you want to weigh in on that? That sounds like somebody who could help with a reputational problem manufacturing has
yes.
for some people.
Steve, we should enlist you to the cause. I agree. The death of manufacturing in Massachusetts is overrated. Barry Bluestone at Northeastern University School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs does a manufacturing report card, and his most recent one, I believe, was last year, and he showed that manufacturing is doing relatively quite well here. But that's not to say that it can't do much better. And one of the things that he emphasizes in his report is the what Ben mentioned, which is that so many of these jobs are, being retired out of, and we need to rejuvenate the workforce. We also, I believe, should be building manufacturing as a sector in the state economy, and that the best places to do that are in the gateway cities.
Let's take another caller. This is Jeremy calling from Rhode Island. And Jeremy, your thoughts on this idea of innovation?
Hi, so I am actually an organic landscaper, but my emphasis is on edible gardens. And yeah. I came that way through coursework at a local community college on organic agriculture. A number of my friends now are farmers who are participating in the CSA model or direct marketing model. And it's something that's really catching on, and I think is part of a reskilling of the country that those of us who may have been left out by the loss of opportunity during the financial crisis are now reevaluating how we can live more sustainably.
And Jeremy, would you say, without sharing numbers, you make a reasonable living doing what you do? Is it financially viable?
So it's something that is developing for sure, but I can say without sharing numbers that in the past 3 years since I've launched entirely on my own doing this, every year my gross revenue has tripled.
Ah, that's interesting.
And so I'm also projecting, looking forward, that I'll be busy installing edible gardens for people through next spring.
Interesting.
And the way that I've been drumming up business is also part of not necessarily a traditional way. I'm going to vendor fairs. I'm meeting people one-on-one. And it's through those encounters, really at the grassroots local level, where I'm finding that there's interest and people are all over the place really reconnecting to the idea that we can do this for ourselves.
Jeremy, thank you for that. And I think your idea of sort of connecting with people ties into why we see so many farmers doing CSAs and coming to farmers markets. It's been a good way to try to get out there. Another caller, this is Evan from Rutland, Massachusetts. And Evan, you're on the air.
How you doing? Thank you so much, and I really appreciate this conversation. I have to say, I mean, I think that I'm a 25-year-old, and I'm in the green economy as part of it, working in a company from Boston, and, you know, and I really have aims and hope to pursue this and move into farming in general, and I think there are a lot of people my age who want to do that, but there aren't any direct ways to employment there that are obvious, and, you know, I think it needs to be a convergence of kind of old technologies and new technologies. Solar farms in conjunction with conventional farms, I mean, there needs to be some way of fabricating and synergizing these new things so that we can, you know, so that employment in this field doesn't have to be a negative wage thing. There are ways to do it so people could earn money and utilize sustainable new technologies. Microhomes is something that's taking off everywhere in this country. I mean, that's something that young people, you know, could get behind and do in addition to this that, you know, that hasn't been discussed here. But I think that there's a real potential for people to enter the market and do so in a way that can make them money, too.
Evan, thank you for that. Evan, thank you very much. And actually, Ben, that ties nicely into what you talked about, which is it's a combination of the old and the new, and there have to be pathways for people to follow these paths if they want to do it. So I think these are all important points. I also want to mention we don't have time for more callers, but there is a caller who was going to bring up, because I know from my producer notes here, the high cost of land, which is a problem for many people who'd like to get into farming, which is a conversation in itself, particularly in a dense, high real estate area like Massachusetts. I want to say thank you to our guest. This has been Ben Schreckinger, who wrote an article in the Boston Globe about innovation. Ben, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
In the studio, Catherine Tumber, visiting scholar at Northeastern University. Catherine, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Molly Anderson, on faculty at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine, who's been joining us by phone from Maine. Molly, thanks to you, too.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Bill Littlefield sizes up the Red Sox Hall of Fame inductees, including Roger Clemens. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.